Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Floss Weekly is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com. This is Floss Weekly with Randall Schwartz and Leo Laporte, episode 60 for March 14th, 2009. Boink! This show is brought to you by listeners like you and your contributions. We couldn't do it without you. Thanks so much. It's time for Floss Weekly, the show all about open source software, free Libre and open source software. It's not a dental show. If you've tuned in for flossing advice, I'm afraid you'll have to go elsewhere. It's Randall Schwartz from Stonehenge.com, pro programmer and Seaside and Squeak programmer extraordinaire. Hello, Randall.
Hey, Leo. Good to talk to you again.
It's great to talk to you. And another exciting adventure into open source software this week. Who are you talking to?
We are talking to David Anderson. David Anderson is a professor at Berkeley, from what I understand. And he is, I believe, the creator and current coordinator for the Boink project. The Boink project here. Now, what is this called for? It stands for the Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing. And the purpose of Boink is to allow problems that are very, very computationally intensive and to farm them out to millions of computers all over the world so each one can do a little piece of it. If you might have heard of SETI at home, this would be an example of something that was done with Boink. We also talked in the last couple of shows, we mentioned that folding at home was sort of the same thing. It's right. The same kind of thing, but I don't think folding at home is actually done with
another program. Yeah.
Yeah. But that's the concept, though, is that basically you take unused computing power when you're not otherwise, you know, sitting at your desk or whatever, or even if you are using the sort of the background processing that you're doing that you don't need anyway, and using it for really worthwhile projects, like SETI at home was for analyzing outer space data or radio data from outer space to see if there was any sort of pattern in the data, to see if there's actually somebody out there, that sort of thing. And I'm sure there's many other projects that we'll get into talking about in terms of what Boink is actually doing.
Well, let's call him up from Berkeley, California, Dr. David P. Anderson of Boink. So, we were debating what Boink stands for, and we figured it out. It's Berkeley Open Infrastructure for Network Computing. Is that right?
Yep, you got it.
And what is it?
Well, it's middleware that lets scientists create volunteer computing projects.
It's what's used for SETI at home? Folding at home?
It's not used for folding at home.
Okay.
They have their own software that they've developed over the years.
SETI does use it, though.
SETI and a set of about 50 or 60 other projects use it currently.
Interesting. Was it designed for SETI?
Not specifically. I was involved in the development of SETI at home, so I certainly learned a lot of lessons about what this type of middleware had to do. But I started working on it in 2002, really with the goal of opening up that whole area. So instead of just having a couple of projects, that there would be scores or hundreds of them. And when I was designing it, I talked to a lot of scientists who were doing who wanted to use volunteer computing in areas like climate modeling and physics and molecular biology and mathematics. To try to figure out what the requirements of their different application areas were, sort of folded all that into the design of the software.
I like the name volunteer computing. That's a great name. Yeah, I've always thought of it as kind of distributed processing.
Well, I like to use volunteer computing because it separates it from things like cluster computing, grid computing, cloud computing. There's all these ways of getting a bunch of computers on a network to work together on a big problem. Mm-hmm. But it makes a big difference if those computers are all in a room or if they all belong to the same organization or to different organizations that trust each other. The key thing about volunteer computing is that you don't know who the computers belong to. You know, basically anybody in the world who has a PC can participate, and that means that some of the computers are unreliable, some of them may be malicious and send you back bad results. The computers are extremely heterogeneous. So all these things have a big impact on how the software that runs the whole thing has to work.
Yeah, I know that wasn't one of the problems in the early SETI at home, is that people were sending back false work units and trying to get out of the leaderboard that way.
Yeah.
What do you do to combat
we're on the
that?
Leaderboard, aren't we, for our...
For folding. That's not related to here.
Oh, yeah.
Stop bringing up folding now. Sorry.
I just like to mention that we're on the leaderboard for folding.
Okay.
That's all.
Right. So how do you combat that in Boink? How do you make sure that somebody isn't just sending something up just to get a credit?
Yeah. So there's two related problems. One is when people rig the software so that it sends back what looks like a valid result, but actually is the result of an earlier computation. Basically, they're claiming that they did some computation that they didn't actually do. Or they could also do the correct computation, but claim that it took a lot more CPU time than it did, and that therefore they should get more credit for it.
So people are using the fact that this leaderboard exists to try to game the system. That's so reprehensible.
Well, yeah. I mean, the existence of the leaderboard
creates this need.
Yeah, and for a lot of people, the leader, you know, they never look at the leaderboard. What they're interested in doing is contributing to the to the scientific cause, whether it's figuring out how proteins work or discovering pulsars or what have you. But I think a big fraction of the participants like the competitive aspect. Or at the very least, they like to have a numerical measure of how much work they've actually done, and so the software has to provide that in a reliable way.
Right.
Now, to get back to your question, the basic mechanism to solve both of these problems, bad results and exaggerated claim credit, is to do replication, to take the same job and run it on two different computers, computers belonging to different people, so they can't collude with each other, and comparing the results. If you run the same program in different computers, generally you get either an identical answer or answers that are numerically fairly close. And if you don't, you know that one of the computations was wrong, and you can run the thing on a third computer and keep on going until you get an agreement.
And I guess because you have so many volunteers, you can afford to do a little bit of redundancy like that.
Yeah, you can afford it. Of course, it reduces the total work that you get done by a factor of two.
Yeah.
So one of the things that we've been working on in the past few months is a refinement of that, where we do replication only with computers that we don't trust very much. Basically, as a computer returns more and more results that are validated by replication, it builds up kind of a good reputation. And once this reputation exceeds a threshold, then we still replicate occasionally to detect situations, to keep the bad guys from gaming the system and building up a good reputation, and then sending back junk after that.
Right.
So we continue to randomly mix in replicated jobs indefinitely. But overall, we can reduce the overhead of this replication from twofold down to just a little bit over one.
It must be interesting figuring out what kinds of projects would work well with this kind of a setup, because if you're running it on a lot of different machines, you have to deal with either code that's written in a really high-level language so it can be compiled in a lot of different places, or with optimizing it for some architectures, then is that a problem with this?
Well, it's kind of up to the projects that use Boink how far down this road they want to go of getting their application to to run with maximal efficiency on every computer in the world.
Mm-hmm.
The easiest thing to do is just to compile it for 32-bit Windows, and you will, you know, you'll be able to run on roughly 85% of the computers involved.
Mm-hmm.
The overall breakdown being 85% Windows, you know, 7% Mac, 7% Linux, and 1% other. However, there are different varieties of Intel processors, and you might want to have a version for AMD or 64-bit processors.
Mm-hmm.
Recently, a lot of projects have been looking at developing applications that run on GPUs instead of or in addition to CPUs. All these things, of course, require some work on the part of the application developers. So the kind of the big well-funded projects like Folding at Home have developed versions for a lot of different architectures. Folding at Home has versions both for ATI and for NVIDIA GPUs, for example.
Mm-hmm.
A few of the Boink-based projects now have versions for NVIDIA GPUs. A couple of them are looking into ATI as well.
Wow. Now, how are you involved with Boink?
Oh, I created the project and continue to run it.
Mm-hmm.
It's the project is funded by the National Science Foundation. The goal of the whole thing is to make more computing power available to scientists and, you know, people who do computational science in all fields. And the National Science Foundation is also real interested in doing things that educate the public about science, get the public involved. Mm-hmm. And volunteer computing is a really good way of doing that. The fact that your computer is helping a particular research project kind of gives you a feeling of belonging there. You know, that its accomplishments are your accomplishments.
Yeah, I'm wondering how many people found out about SETI because of SETI at Home.
Exactly. Yeah.
It would be a huge number. I know that I mean, I was when I started running SETI at Home, I was much more interested in what was happening with SETI than before that. It wasn't just Carl Sagan saying something somewhere. It was actually something that I was involved in because my computers were helping it out somehow.
Well, we've never measured that, but we think that that there was a large effect. I think there are, at least in the American public, there's probably a lot of people who equate SETI with looking for wrecked UFOs in the desert.
You're probably right. Yeah.
You know, people who just read tabloids in supermarkets think of it in terms of little green men. Mm-hmm. Of course, when you run SETI at Home and start reading our website and learning about what we're actually doing, it's a very sober, very skeptical endeavor. We're looking at these radio waves coming from outer space that have traveled for thousands or tens of thousands of years. And most of it is white noise. We're trying to find, you know, signals that are different from white noise. It's a very unspectacular thing, but it's the leading scientific approach to trying to find life outside Earth. So it's kind of interesting.
When you sat down to design Boink, did you design something that was at first specific to SETI at Home, or did you know, well, I want to be able to operate on arbitrary data sets? Did you build the backbone first?
A project that I was very interested in supporting was this thing called climateprediction.net, which is based at Oxford University. They had, in 1999, they had published an article that sort of announced their interest in using volunteer computing to do climate research. This involves running these immense programs that model the Earth's entire climate system, the ocean, the atmosphere, the clouds, the effects of volcanoes and sun, things like this, with the goal of improving the accuracy of predictions of what's going to happen to the Earth's climate in 50 years or 100 years. This happens to be a problem that requires near infinite computing power. And in my mind, it was one of the more important things that we could do, or important things that we can use computers for. So I actually went over to Oxford and spent a few days with them talking about their application, which had a number of very unusual properties. One of them was that the jobs, the units of computation, took about 6 months.
Ooh.
Whereas with SETI at home, at that point, jobs took about 6 or 8 hours.
Right. And,
now they're down to 30, 40 minutes on a modern computer.
Mm-hmm.
But climate prediction, like I say, the jobs took 6 months. That meant that we had to build in mechanisms. You know, for example, it wouldn't be good if we waited for, the guy downloads a job, runs it for 6 months, and he doesn't get any credit until the 6 months is up.
Or forgets to upload, or gets a new system.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So we had to build in some mechanisms to sort of update the server periodically rather than waiting for jobs to be over. Also, the application generated enormous output files. SETI at home, everything is in the few megabytes range. Climate prediction, the files were gigabytes or a few gigabytes, and we needed to put in a mechanism where the scientists could kind of look at a summary of the results and decide whether it was worth the trouble to upload the entire 2 gigabyte output file that contained the details of the whole simulation. A bunch of little things like that. There were a lot of requirements of climate prediction that I would have never thought of.
Mm-hmm.
And for the first year or so, as different projects popped up using Boink, each one of them had some new wrinkle that required adding some features to Boink. And the challenge was to do this in a coherent way, rather than just sort of bolting on a new feature here and there to do it in a general way where it would be more easily extensible.
So does the client side, the stuff that I'm actually running on my machine, does that look like a framework in which the actual meat of the program is sort of dropped in the middle of then?
Yeah. So the client software consists of a couple of pieces. It just looks like one program, but under the hood, there's a program called the core client that communicates with the servers of the different projects you're participating in.
Mm-hmm.
One of the key features of Boink is you don't have to restrict yourself just to one project.
Oh, that's nice. Because I look at your project page, there's a lot of stuff I'd like to participate in.
Yeah, and you don't have to pick either SETI at home or Folding at home, and that's it. You can pick whatever combination you want. You could pick all of them, and it lets you give a sort of a share. You can say, I want a third of my resources to go to SETI and 2/3 to climate modeling, or whatever ratios you want.
Wow.
This core client program communicates with project servers. It tells them about the details of your computer. Its hardware, how much free disk space it has, what other jobs it currently has, and gets back a description of some jobs to do, which include a list of files to download, both the data files and the executables. And then the core client runs those programs, which could take hours or weeks. It uploads the result files, and when it's all done, it reports back to the project servers and asks for more work. And it tries to balance out the work between the different projects according to the ratios that you specified.
Now, is this phoning back home to the Boink machines then? I mean, is that all centralized regardless of which project I'm specifically working on?
There actually really is no central part of Boink. one of the big design decisions in Boink was to have all the projects be completely independent and self-contained. So each project has its own servers, in some cases a bunch of different servers that manage all the distribution of work. When you have an account, each project has its own database of accounts and teams and everything like that. I kind of wanted to set things up so that if one project should fail or server should go down, it shouldn't affect other projects. And if Boink itself should go away, these projects should still continue to operate. So there really is nothing centralized about Boink except our website that lets you download this client software and a wiki, a lot of documentation, stuff like that. But in terms of the operational part of it, there's nothing centralized.
Is the server software similar then for these different projects, or do they write their own up to a protocol or something?
Most of the server software is generic. It's part of Boink. Mm-hmm. Boink defines a database structure that they all have, a bunch of PHP pages that provide part of their website, and the backend components that issue and handle jobs. The projects do write bits of software in the backend. So, for example, this task of comparing two different job outputs and deciding if they're the same. For some applications, you need to have kind of a fuzzy comparison. You need to have a fudge factor because different processors do floating point math a little bit differently. Mm-hmm. So that particular logic is something the projects have to supply. But the goal is to minimize the amount of programming or other sort of work that projects have to do.
So it's almost off the shelf then. Basically, somebody could be up and running rather quickly in their particular thing once they figure out what a work unit looks like.
Yeah, that's the goal, is that a scientist should be able to set up a server, port an existing application to the framework, and get the whole thing up and running in, a man day of work, perhaps.
That's very cool. Very cool. What protocol do you use to get from the front end to the back end? Are you hitting a web page, or you got your own TCP connection going on?
The communication between the client and these different project servers is entirely over, it's HTTP over port 80.
Wow.
So it looks exactly like web access. That's pretty much mandatory because a lot of computers, especially, computers at work behind firewalls, are only able to connect out to the world in port 80.
Right.
They may go through proxies that require the communication to be HTTP.
Mm-hmm. That's a pretty pretty good design then. That's really nice.
Yeah, it's worked out pretty well.
Almost a necessity. I mean, absolutely a necessity, I guess. Yeah.
Yeah.
So how many people are using volunteer computing right now in the Boink project? I'm sure it's on the webpage, right? But I'm not looking at the webpage.
It's a lot. If you look at the webpage, you get the hundreds of thousands of users. It's quite interesting.
Yeah. The order of magnitude is that there are, I think, about 320,000 people, humans, and a lot of those people have more than one computer. So the number of computers, I think, is about 560,000.
Wow.
And that's, like I say, that's spread across a large number of projects.
The biggest one is SETI at Home?
The biggest one is still SETI at Home, a little surprisingly. But other major projects include this thing called IBM World Community Grid, Einstein at Home, Rosetta at Home, climateprediction.net.
All right, you got to tell us now. What's Einstein at Home? You're trying to make a little Einstein?
It's slightly analogous to SETI at Home in the sense that it's looking at data coming from space. Ah. In this case, the data is there are these things called gravitational waves that are predicted by Einstein's general theory of relativity. When a mass moves, it produces this ripple in space-time that actually propagates like a wave. And in the past few years, people have built the first detectors of gravitational waves. The detectors are these incredible things. They're in big caves under the ground with giant mirrors with laser beams bouncing back and forth between them. What Einstein at Home does is it analyzes data from these gravitational wave detectors, and it's looking for a very specific thing, which is called a gravitational pulsar, which is a collapsed star that's a little bit asymmetrical. It has a bulge, and as it spins around, these things rotate really fast. As it spins around, the asymmetry causes a gravitational wave to be emitted, and nobody knows if these things exist. The project is trying to find the first one.
Wow.
So why is Einstein in that phrase then?
Well, because it's his theory that predicts that gravitational waves exist.
Oh, okay, right. Sorry, I missed
that.
And
it's kind of a new way of observing the universe. You know, all the telescopes we have, radio telescopes, optical, infrared, it's all in the electromagnetic spectrum. And gravitational waves are just a completely different thing. It's kind of a new way of looking at the universe.
It's really neat to have these big computing projects like climate, like this Einstein project, that really would be difficult, if not impossible, to solve without this volunteer computing, right? I mean, it's a huge amount of computing power you're getting.
Well, it's all economics. I think that if you had enough money to spend, you could buy several supercomputers and you'd have the equivalent of SETI at Home.
Right.
But most of these projects don't have a lot of money. In particular, SETI, the SETI at Home group, doesn't have almost any money. Climate research has traditionally been somewhat underfunded. So it's really a question of economics.
Yeah.
And I've actually gone through and done a little bit of analysis and compared the cost of getting computing cycles by putting together your own cluster, you know, buying the hardware, your network fabric, compared with volunteer computing, the cluster approach is it's about 100 times more expensive.
Wow.
And this new thing called cloud computing, where a big company like Amazon or Google has huge numbers of computers and rents you time on them, that works well for some things, but if you just want a lot of computing cycles, that's 10 times more expensive than building your own cluster.
So what's Rosetta at Home?
Rosetta is one of several projects. They're doing something very similar to Folding at Home. They're taking genetic sequence information, you know, the sequence of GTCs and A's in genomes for humans and other organisms, mm-hmm. and trying to predict what proteins come out of those. The gene sequence tells you a sequence of amino acids, but it doesn't tell you the three-dimensional shape that the protein molecule has. And the shape is real important. Like if you're trying to find a drug that will dock with a cancer cell and inhibit it, you need to know the shape of the proteins on the cancer cell.
Mm. So this is kind of a Rosetta Stone for microbiology.
I think the name, the name is Rosetta was a pre-existing application that did protein folding. The project, you know, is a distributed version of that application. Yeah, I think the idea is that the genome is like a Rosetta Stone for the physiology of the organism.
Yeah, we've talked a little bit about this, I think, on our Futures in Biotech show. Actually, it's really cool stuff.
I see LHC at Home, the Large Hadron Collider. What's that about?
That one is from CERN, the physics research lab in Switzerland, which, you know, is the world's most powerful collider. Mm-hmm. That project runs well. They've run a couple of applications, both related to the accelerator. The first one was it actually ran a simulation of the way that protons and antiprotons move around the accelerator and are bent by the superconducting magnets. Essentially, they're trying to simulate the way the whole thing worked and improve the design of it so that the magnets would focus the proton beams more tightly, which makes the accelerator work better. Recently, they've been running an application that simulates the collisions of protons and antiprotons. And eventually, we kind of hope that that project may be used to actually analyze the data that comes out of the collider.
Right. Once it gets up and running again, should have a lot of data that probably will need crunching somewhere.
Yeah, that application is kind of the ultimate in both of compute intensive and data intensive tasks. You know, the instrument produces I don't know the numbers, but it's terabytes of data per day, and to figure out what's going on with all those particles flying around, you need a lot of computer time. So that's an application that might eventually work well for volunteer computing.
To give you an idea of the kind of power here, your 24-hour average is 1.3 teraflops. And you've got some people like, I'm looking on the front page, Chilma is contributing 780 gigaflops of power on his team. I mean, it's kind of amazing. Are there any jobs on here that you couldn't do even if you could afford a couple of supercomputers?
Well, just to talk about numbers. So the easiest unit to use these days is a petaflop. And the fastest supercomputer, which is called the Roadrunner, IBM builds it, is on the order of one petaflop. It's depending on what the application is, it could be a little bit higher. So one petaflop is the current fastest supercomputer. These Boink-based projects together get about 1.4 petaflops.
Wow!
And
so you aren't anywhere in the area of replacing big iron yet.
No, not at all.
But maybe if we can get us a few more people to volunteer.
Well, the thing that there's a couple of factors in how we can move this whole thing to the next couple of orders of magnitude. One is getting more people to volunteer. 320,000 is a big number, but out of the 1 billion people who currently own computers, it's a tiny drop in the bucket. We think that those 320,000, are basically the nerds, the geeks.
Yeah, of course. People who listen to this show.
Yeah. The majority of people own computers these days. It's an appliance. You own it like a telephone or a television set. And to reach those people, I don't know. We either have to get the software bundled, or get some coverage on the mass media or something like that. We think it should be possible to move from the neighborhood of 500,000 people up to 5 or 10 or 20 million with the right publicity partners. Mm. So hopefully that'll happen.
You say right publicity partners, you're talking Pepsi? Who you want to have promote this?
The Boink of a new generation.
free Madonna songs if you boink.
It could be Pepsi. It could be a big computer company.
Gosh knows, there's a lot of idle CPUs out there. There's at least 200 million people running Windows just sitting there.
Yeah. It could be the Discovery Channel.
It
could be an existing media outlet. I don't know, National Geographic. We're kind of waiting for somebody to step up and realize the importance of doing this.
Right.
Maybe Scientific American should have a big article on it.
No kidding.
Talk to those guys next week. So,
Yeah. Another dimension is that these GPUs, these graphics processing units, they've become a lot faster than CPUs. So if you buy a late model NVIDIA chip, it does about a teraflop, which is about 100 times as much as your late model Intel chip.
Well, and it's designed to do what you do, which is operate across masses of data.
Well, it turns out that GPUs are actually really effective for a lot of different scientific applications.
Yeah, yeah.
They're designed to to render polygons and play video games fast, but they're actually very good at things like climate modeling, things like protein simulations.
Interesting.
If we can kind of combine these two things, get the use of a lot more GPUs and get the number of participants up into the several million range, we'll have the potential to go far beyond the petaflop level. It's actually conceivable that we could reach the next multiple of 1,000 beyond that, which is called exaflops. An exaflop would be 4 million late model GPUs all running at the same time.
Wow.
And that seems completely feasible. And that's something that would be impossible to do with supercomputer technology.
One thing I've noticed with folding at home is that because they support the PS3 and that cell processor, they've got a lot of gigaflops flying out the door there. Does Boink support other platforms besides Mac, Windows, and Linux?
There is one Boink project that has an application that runs in the PlayStation 3, but only if you're running Linux on your PlayStation 3.
Okay.
The operating system that Sony ships with the PlayStation 3 is proprietary.
Right.
You can't even compile an application for it unless you get Sony's permission, basically.
So somebody at Folding at Home made a good deal when they got that installed on the PS3 by default.
Well, so, basically, Sony came to Folding at Home and offered to port their application to the cell processor.
Sony, and, Boink, much smarter. You'd have a whole bunch of projects. Sony,
true.
That's the kind of partner, really, that could make a big difference. Yeah.
What about, you know, there's always talk about being green. And I think if I'm running Boink on my machine when I'm not actually typing it, I'm using up more electricity, right, and generating more heat. Is that ever an issue as people are talking about all these projects that are about global warming and actually warming the globe as a result?
Well, that is an issue. And originally we thought of SETI at Home as screensaver computing. It would... Mm-hmm. It wouldn't compute while you're at your computer, and then it would kick in when it was idle and run the rest of the night. These days, of course, people are becoming aware of electricity usage, and we've sort of shifted things around. So the idea is you do the computing while you're at your computer, and Boink, the default configuration is that it quits computing once you leave and allows your computer to go into into its low energy state or, turn off or whatever it is you want to do.
Oh, that's interesting.
With a modern operating system like Vista or Linux, if you run an application at zero priority, it doesn't have any visible impact on the performance of the computer. It doesn't slow down your typing or your web browsing. So now it is true that the difference between doing, email and web browsing and having a floating point intensive application running in terms of energy usage, there is a difference. It's it's on the order of 20 or 30 watts, which is small. It's a fraction of the overall total, but it is something. We just encourage people to be aware of that, the impact of that, and to make sure that the scientific value of what they're doing, exceeds the carbon impact of it.
It would be interesting. I don't know if you have this in there, but it would be interesting to have it be able to turn off during the hours of peak electricity usage in big cities.
Yeah. And another factor is that if you live in a place that's cold, then your computer, from an energy point of view, acts like a space heater.
Yeah.
And
you should be in my office, David. I have 8 or 9 CPUs in here, and it's never cool. Never.
It's nice and toasty.
Yeah. In the winter, it's great. In the summer, you don't like it so much.
Certainly, the cats have figured that out.
Oh yeah, they know where to. They know to sleep on this. They sleep on the PlayStation 3.
Yeah.
So, well, we do notice that the rate of computing goes down a little bit in the summer, and that's probably why.
Yeah, sure. I bet it is. Yeah. It is. It is something to be aware of. But at the same time, I think a lot of people are leaving their machines on anyway. Now, will Boink keep them from going to a low power state? It keeps the machine running, right?
Well, it varies between operating systems. Windows currently, if your CPU usage is above a certain threshold, then it won't go into low power state. So, on Linux, I believe that it does.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. And but
you'd get less flops then. Fewer flops, I guess, would be the correct grammar.
Well, you know, we'd like to give people the power to, you know,
control
have whatever policy it is that they want.
Sure.
Exactly. And we're trying to get make Microsoft aware of the situation and get them to set things up so that, you know, for example, if there's computing but it's being done at zero priority, then let the computer go into its low power state. That would be the ideal policy.
Mick in our chat room says he's going to stop ironing his shirts and continue to use folding or SETI at home. And that's probably a pretty good trade, actually. There's a lot of things we do that use energy, after all. And wrinkled shirts aren't the end of the world.
Yeah. Well, you know, another thing about GPUs is that the watts per flop is... They're much more energy efficient than CPUs.
Yeah.
And actually, the most energy efficient processors going are the ones that are in mobile devices like cell phones and PDAs.
Right.
And recently, a couple of college students from Israel ported Boink and SETI at home to run on a cell phone.
Wow.
And I'm not sure if this is going to go anywhere, but it's kind of an intriguing idea. You know, there's 3 billion cell phones out there, right. And to compute on them while they're sitting recharging at night would be a lot of power.
So only at home then.
That's right. I don't think you'd want it wearing down your cell phone while you're
drain your battery
during the day, and it's just the battery's dead in 10 minutes. That'd be pretty bad.
I think it's just an amazing idea, David. And how did it come to you in a flash? How did it come to you?
Certainly not in a flash. I don't think I'm that smart. but I'm a computer scientist, sort of old school. Back in the 80s, I got my degree, and I taught here at Berkeley for a number of years. And I've been, this operating systems, distributed systems is sort of what I do.
Okay.
And
the idea of clustering computers together was not alien to you in any way.
No, and actually, I've been kind of thinking about using the internet as a way to do parallel computing,
right.
I think back in 1985, but the whole thing kind of became more feasible in the 90s when ISPs like AOL and CompuServe started to get large numbers of subscribers. You know, there were millions or tens of millions of people on the internet for the first time. And also the fact that the average consumer PC at that point, it started becoming, more powerful than you really needed and able to, potentially do some serious computing and run these scientific applications.
What's Sonic Solutions?
Oh, that's one of the companies that I worked for between my academic career and my study at home career.
And distributed digital audio editing?
Well, that's what they did back then.
Mm-hmm. How do you even do that?
Well, this is back in, I think, about 1992. They built systems that were used by, for example, big movie studios working on the soundtracks for movies. Turns out that movie soundtracks have huge numbers of independent channels of audio going on at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's like seven different speakers that they're driving, and there's like, the music, the sound effects, the dialogue. So Sonic Solutions built these Macintosh-based systems that use special DSP boards, ganged together with SCSI buses, and it was actually a distributed system. You could have the the sound data coming in from a file server across the network. So it's kind of an interesting application for me. I had done a bunch of research in real-time systems and, you know, how do you handle audio and video data without having glitches or dropouts. And of course, the whole thing gradually became irrelevant as Intel processors became so fast that you didn't need to build any special purpose hardware for it.
What is the difference in quality or power between the CPU and the GPU? How much bang for your buck are you getting now that you're moving to GPU computing?
Well, like I say, with you know, the snapshot of the way things are right now, the GPU is somewhere between 10 and 100 times faster than the CPU.
So for every 10 to 100 GPU users, I mean, that's every 10 to 100 CPU users, one GPU user can do the same work. That's amazing.
Yeah. And, you know, there's this thing called Moore's Law that graphs the rate of, speed increase or actually transistor count increase.
Right.
And the doubling time for CPUs rather has averaged about 18 months. You know, each 18 months, the average CPU chip gets twice as fast. But for GPUs, the doubling time has been 8 months.
Wow.
So they're currently faster, and they're getting faster a lot faster.
They're getting faster, faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. Wow.
What's Stardust at home?
Oh, Jesus. You guys are really making me work here.
You know, you just go to boinc.berkeley.edu. You click the Choose Projects button, and you can see the whole list there.
Well, no, looks like Stardust is something different.
What is that?
Yeah, Stardust is something different. So the place that I work at is called Space Sciences Laboratory. I'm located here just because of SETI at home. You know, I got an office and I've stuck around here. But a lot of other interesting stuff goes on here. One of the projects involved basically people build things that get sent up into space, telescopes and, you know, different instruments. One of the projects involved collecting dust from outer space, and they sent out a satellite out past Mars, and it had kind of a dust collector, this panel of this material called aerogel, and they opened it up, and it collected a few hundred particles of interstellar dust.
Yeah.
Then the whole thing flew back to Earth and was parachuted down, and we wanted to extract these dust particles and, you know, figure out where they came from. But the problem was how to find where the dust particles were in this collector. The way to do it was to take microphotographs of it and look for these sort of little holes that the dust particle makes.
So they're molecule sized. I mean, they're really tiny.
They're not molecule sized, but they're, you know, submicron sized.
Wow.
And it turned out that computer vision didn't really work very well for this, but human vision did. Visual tasks are something where the humans can still do better than computers in most cases.
Hmm.
So we had hundreds of thousands of these microphotographs to look at and try to find these dust particles. And, you know, only one or two graduate students, and they refused to work on that. So we set up this project where volunteers over the internet could just look at these pictures. They're actually kind of sort of a focus knob you can turn to look up and down through this material. And we set up a little training course where we train people and, you know, give them a test and then turn them loose. And it worked spectacularly well. We got about 25,000 people, each of whom spent, I think, about 40 hours on average doing this task. It was something where I don't know how else we could have done it.
Wow.
There's too much data to look at, but with the help of all these people, we got it done. And that idea is something that it's been used in other areas. You know, there was this thing called the ESP game where people try to tag words to photographs. There's different areas of this idea of crowdsourcing, of getting the internet population to help you with a problem. in the context of science, my phrase for that is distributed thinking. It's like distributed computing, but we're right. using human brains instead of computers. And that's actually become a real interest of mine, and I'm working on software to help scientists set up distributed thinking projects, sort of analogous to Boink.
I do that all the time, by the way. I use my chat room to remind me what I'm supposed to be doing and thinking right now. It's very effective. That's very cool. That aerogel is something else. What a neat project that is. What did you come up with? Was there any interesting results from that Stardust project?
Yeah, well, they've located several dozen dust particles, and there's now a second phase of it, which is looking for much smaller dust particles than people thought they could find originally. So the idea is that once you locate the particles, there's this micro machine that goes in and slices out a tiny cube of aerogel that contains the dust particle. And then you run it through a bunch of different machines that analyze it and, figure out what kind of supernova it came from and this kind of stuff.
Oh, amazing.
Wow.
Yeah. It's kind of mind boggling that the first solid matter from outside the solar system is sitting in the office next door to me.
Star stuff.
Yeah.
That's pretty new. Any conclusions yet?
Oh, I'm sure there have been. I don't really follow that, but they give talks about it. It's really stunning how much they can learn about kind of the origins, the stellar processes that produce this stuff, and just from a very tiny amount of these crystal dust particles.
Stardust.jpl.nasa.gov. They have a great page on that. Mm-hmm. Well, Boink is very cool. I'm really grateful to you for writing it. Obviously, it's kind of cool that you can write a project, write a program and start a project that will do so much good and has so much growth potential for it. We want to get more people using it.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead.
It's been a lot of fun for me, certainly in contrast to working on commercial products where, half the time they end up in the trash can anyway. doing something that has a positive impact is a lot of fun.
There's something called Grid Republic and BAM. These allow you to do, these are account managers that allow you to do multiple Boink projects on one system. Is that the idea?
Yeah. The idea is they make it easy to discover Boink projects.
Ah, okay.
Once we get up into the range of, like 50 or 100 Boink projects, this question of, how are you going to find the ones that you want to run? And without these account managers, you would simply have to, do a Google and then go and look at 50 or 60 different websites.
Right.
The account managers show you the whole thing in one place. You can see a list of all the projects, the institutions they're from, summary of the science that they're doing, and then you can sign up for them just by checking a box. So it makes the whole thing much simpler.
Cool. David, thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Really appreciate it. Fascinating stuff. boinc.berkeley.edu. Don't just do it. Just go down and go. I'm going to download it right now. Put it on all my machines, but especially those machines with GPUs, with fast. We should actually, when we deliver the ultimate gaming machine, which has three GFX 280 cards in it, that's the machine. For Boink. We'll deliver it running Boink. And you can decide what else you want to do with it.
Nice.
That'll be a couple of petaflops right there. Yep. Thank you, David.
You're welcome.
Great. Bye-bye. Great to talk to you. Really appreciate it.
Thanks.
David Anderson of Boink.
What a great way to take this hard technology that's sitting in our houses and offices and do something really useful for the planet just by pushing a couple buttons. This is great.
Which one would you do?
Oh man. Well, I don't know. There's so many interesting projects on there. I'm running the folding at home on my PS3, as we've talked about in past
shows.
Yes,
am I. And,
but I tell you, well, I'm still a little partial to SETI. I think it's just I know they're getting a lot of CPU, but I think there's, And I'm kind of hopeful there. I think there's probably something going on. And the climate change one sounded pretty cool too. Although I don't know about a 6-month work unit. That sounds a little like optimistic about how well my machine.
Well, I wonder, did they kind of solve that issue? Didn't they?
Yeah, I hope so.
We actually didn't. I don't know if we ever finished that.
I don't think he said
conversation, but yeah. They must have resolved that.
Yeah. Okay. Good.
There's Milky Way at home, Cosmology at home, Prime Grib, ABC at home, distributed rainbow table generator.
Now, prime rib at home, that would be
good. Yeah. What are you doing with your computer? We're building a cow.
Where's the beef? So, I downloaded the beef.
So, Randall, you're going to be back from your cruise for our next week's episode, yes?
Yes, but I am, as people are listening to this show, I am currently out at sea. And in fact, if you go over to my other podcast, podcast.insightcruises.com, you'll hear the final third part of Ira Flatow, the guy from Science Friday, talking about the catalysts of creativity. I talked a little bit on last week's show about that. So if you go over there, you'll hear that. And I will be back in time for next week's taping. So yes, there will be no interruption to this flow of these shows. Speaking of which, what's coming up soon, we are taping next week's show, will be the Arduino project.
Ooh, I'm so excited.
Hardware, open source hardware, people programming stuff, and using the processing language, which we talked about a few weeks back. So very nice, or at least a derivative of processing, I should say.
Yeah.
Coming up after that, we've got eBox, which is allocating machine allocations using 500,000 lines of Perl code. Well, I forgot how well he's been able to manage that.
How do you do that?
We also have Wubby, the Windows Ubuntu installer, so you can run Ubuntu without having to create a separate partition or completely blow your current partition. And then immediately after that, a recent addition to the schedule, we've got Jono Bacon, who is the Ubuntu community manager, talking about how to build communities, about the whole general nature of open source and stuff. I'm looking forward to that show. That's going to be a really good show.
He is a rock star, I am told.
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. So those are the upcoming shows that I currently have scheduled, and we're scheduling more furiously to make sure that this pipeline stays full for April, May, and June, and until I get tired of doing this.
You the man, Randall Schwartz. You the man.
Thank you, sir.
Where are you going?
Where am I going? Where
on
am
your
I at
cruise?
Right now?
Where are you
I?
At?
I am probably coming back. Actually, I think today I'm going to be coming out of the Panama Canal. We go into the canal.
It's a weird thing.
Out.
You don't go through it. You go in and out.
And that's because it costs $100,000 just to do that part of it.
So if you did it, wow.
Yeah, so I'm glad there's 1,400 passengers each picking up their little share of it. Yes.
Wow, that's a
insane.
Lot of money.
It's
wow.
a lot of money, yes.
I've always wanted to do that, though. So is this a 10-day or it must be a 10-day cruise, then?
It's a 10-day cruise, right. Yeah. And so I will have already been at Aruba and Curacao and Holland America's private island. And I'm also stopping one or two other places along Central America. I forget where they are. Guatemala? No. Something down in there. I forget now. I don't know. I just go where the ship goes. I let the captain steer. And I am in the bar drinking.
That's you drink, that's I'll drive.
Exactly. Exactly. I think there's no problem me drinking on the ship. They're not going to ask me because I'm like the 470th person down the list in terms of who has to get sick before I steer. So I'm okay drinking in the cruise.
So insightcruises.com, and I think March 1st, they're going to close up enrollment for our, so it's probably by the time this airs, it's too late.
Yeah. For the Mac Mania
9.
Yep.
So I hope you signed up. We're going to be in China. This is July. I know we're you and I are taking the land portion. Don McAllister and I are taking the land portion. July 3rd through 8th, and the 8th through the 14th, I think, is the cruise.
Something like that, yeah.
It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm really looking forward to that.
Yeah, I am too. It should be a lot of fun.
Yeah. Well, if you missed, there are plenty more cruises, insightcruises.com. And then, of course, don't forget podcast.insightcruises.com for Randall's cruise podcast with a lot. You know, it's not just like here we are in the boat and it's a beautiful day. You've got great people, Scientific American people, Ira Flatow, great people on this.
Incredible speakers, and I'm really glad that I get to bring a little piece of that home with me and put it on the podcast. The problem with that, of course, is that it's an audio podcast, and a lot of this stuff has visuals. So I apologize about every third show I say, you know, what you really got to do is see this because it's much more interesting than just listening to it. But even the listening part, there's a lot to do, a lot to listen to on these shows.
I think audio is good for ideas. Mm-hmm. I really do. Sure. I think, you know, that's, you know, it's good for abstract ideas.
Well, we occasionally have a speaker say, and as you see here, which of course doesn't work too well for audio.
Hey, have a great trip. Bon voyage, and we'll see you when you come back.
Thanks.
On Floss Weekly.